All right, the one chapter books in the Bible is what we'll what we're going to think about this quarter. And if you just look at our title here, you understand something of why a study like this can be valuable. Obviously, why do these parts of the Bible have one chapter? Well, they are short. That's a good reason. We learned already that God didn't divide the Bible into chapters, but that men did. But obviously, this is not Isaiah. It's not Matthew or something like that. The places that tend to get the more of our attention as we study the scriptures. These are books also that tend to be at least a little more personal in nature. The one that we'll talk about today is addressed just to one particular nation and one situation. The one after this that we'll look at is to one man about one particular problem. And it kind of goes that way with the exception of Jude. It seems to have a little broader context. And because they're so personal in nature, it may tend to seem to us like the application to us is less. In other words, since it was addressed to this person at this time about this problem, it may be harder to see, what's this have to do with me? And what does it have to do with the Lord and so forth? And so that gets to be a part of it. And then the other reason why this, and I mentioned this sort of jokingly a while ago, but why these lessons get to be overlooked is they don't fit real neatly into our usual Bible study patterns or programs, because we're looking at series of studies sometimes. And so here are three reasons why these books tend to be neglected in our study. Now, if you think about this, the fact that we can neglect them, but that God in His providence chose to include them in the collection of His inspired Word, what's that tell us?
Important.
They may have meaning and importance that are not so obvious to us, but that we dare not pass by. And I kind of think that's the case here. So what we're going to do, there are as we've already mentioned, five of these books, one Old Testament and four New Testament books like this. And what we're going to do in this quarter is to take one class with each of these to give you the historical setting and the overview of the material in each one of these books, each one of these letters, if we can call them that in the Scripture. And then we're going to take the next week each time to go back and to dwell more on I'll call the main practical lesson here in this book. In some cases, or in all the cases, of course, there are more lessons than just that one, and there's a couple of these books where that may take us two times, but it will fill up our quarter in that manner, and I hope it'll be some help and understanding, or help and encouragement to each one of you. You need to turn for this morning to the little book of Obadiah in the Old Testament. It's between Amos and Jonah. All right, if that helps you any, to get the landmarks of this. And I need for us, before we actually dig into the material, to have a general Old Testament timeline in our mind so that we'll have an idea of where this fits. And if we let this timeline take us, say, from around 970 to 950 B.C., where we would have King David alive about that period of time. And then if we come down here a couple hundred years to where, if we come here somewhere just before 900, we have the divided kingdom beginning with Judah and Israel existing together. And then 722, where what happens in that year? 722-721 BC. It should tell you when I have a line here and a line here and it says divided kingdom. What happens? All right, the northern kingdom is carried away. Samaria falls. Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel, falls and is carried away by what nation? All right, the Assyrians. All right, then we come along here until about 586 B.C., 587, 586 B.C., and you have, during this period of time, Judah alone. And what happens in 586? Alright, Jerusalem falls at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and the people are carried away by the Babylonians. Then we have the period of captivity, which goes along until about 536 B.C., to make this round numbers, we could call this 586. That's usually when it gets to be pictured. And then this goes along until we get to, say, 450. Ezra comes in 458, and Nehemiah comes in 445, and Jerusalem begins to be restored, or is restored, about that period of time. So I'm going to write it up here like this. So you'll see this is about 445. Jerusalem restored. That's when the walls were restored, although a temple had been rebuilt before then. All right, now, that general timeline gives you a concept of how Old Testament events happen. Now, about Obadiah, just a few things that are interesting details about this. First, Obadiah is one of only a few of the Old Testament books, especially the prophets, that do not specifically say this is when this happened. The others are all set within the context of who were the kings at the time and what was going on. So this is different in that way. It's one of only seven of the Old Testament books that are not directly quoted or referenced in the New Testament. It's kind of interesting in that way. It's the shortest, obviously, Old Testament book. It's kind of interesting in that way also. This Obadiah, the Bible handbook told me that there were 13 Obadiahs mentioned in the Old Testament. We don't know specifically which one this is. His name means servant of the Lord. Not a bad name for a prophet, is it? Servant of the Lord. He is a man who delivers, if you notice, in verse 1 of his work, a message concerning Edom. We'll talk more about that in a minute, but the first and most obvious thing about him is that he is talking to people from Judah about a foreign nation. All right. I've noticed in preaching that if I get up and pour it on somebody else, we all walk out saying, that was a great job. All right. Jeremiah had to preach to Jerusalem about Jerusalem. And he had to say, you're going to face judgment You're going to have to submit to your captors and so forth. Obadiah preaches to people who have from maybe among people who have been through that, about people who have made fun of them while they're going through that. So he has a hard job and an easy job. The easy job is that there are going to be some people who are saying amen, pour it on them. The hard job is getting the people to understand there's a principle here, and the principle is God holds you accountable for how you react to the fate of other people. Other people are responsible for the consequences of their actions, but God expects us to not be people who gloat in the misfortune that befalls other people. That's going to be the main lesson of this book concerning Edom. Now, what about the timing of it? There are the inward details here. There's not a date attached to it, but the inward details suggest that this happens right about here, just shortly after the fall of Jerusalem. And I'll show you a couple of the inward details right now and then some more a little bit later. You notice what happens, for example, verses 10 and 11 of Obadiah. Because of the violence done to your brother Jacob, shame will cover you and you shall be cut off forever. Now, he's not saying they did the violence. Look at verse 11. On the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. Now tell me, what is it that God is saying there? What is the criticism of Edom? You have here. Go ahead.
They didn't help them. They just sat there and enjoyed it.
All right. They didn't help them, but you have here. Let me say it like this: you have Judah, who are the covenant people of God. You have foreigners who, as we know, were the Babylonians here. And which one was Edom like? Whose side did Edom take? All right. Edom, facing this situation, was like the foreigners. Now you ask, well, they were a foreign nation too. Why is that such a problem? How do verses 10 and 11 describe Judah in relation to Edom?
Brothers.
All right. There's the situation now. You have a situation where your brothers are being violently mistreated and all their goods are being carried off and they're facing disaster and foreigners are doing it to them, and you're faced with a choice of sympathy for your brothers or celebration with the foreigners, and you celebrate with the foreigners. All right, that's the situation. Now the question is, why is a foreign nation like Edom referred to as brothers to Judah? And why have relationships gotten so bad between them here that Edom would celebrate with the disaster that fell upon Judah? That's the question. Now, and there is a Bible background to this that's really, really interesting and I think instructive. So let's take a minute to think this over. On the map here, notice that Edom, and And I told Brother Feeney, this map doesn't go far enough south. Edom is the area straight south of the Dead Sea. And it's the main feature of it, of its territory, if you look at it on your Bible map, will be this range of rugged mountains here that are referred to collectively as Mount Seir, Mount S-E-I-R. And the main city, and often with the prophets, you will just hear them denouncing Mount Seir, S-E-I-R, and that stands for Edom. And you'll notice here the contrast drawn between Mount Seir and Mount Zion. What is Mount Zion?
Jerusalem.
All right, it stands for Jerusalem, and in particular, the mountains upon which the temple would have been built, right? That area. So the contrast between the two here. The main cities of Edom were called, I think, Teman and Bozrah, not the Basra in Iraq today, but Bozrah. We're talking about the city south of here. From the Gulf of Aqaba, which is down here on the map, let me see if I can show you. Yeah, down here. From this up through toward the Dead Sea and up through the area, there was what was called the King's Highway, that were a trade route that ran from here right alongside the range of Mount Seir up through the territory of Edom, that would take you up by the Dead Sea and then on up to Jerusalem. It was an area rich in resources because of that, and it was an area that was typically easily defended. Mount Seir had very rocky, rugged areas with narrow passes in them, and you could take a few men and defend an army trying to get to you. A little bit after this time here, the Nabataeans took this territory, and they built a city called Petra. In my best Bible handbook, John has right now, so it has a color picture of this. And I want to show you the Nabataeans, who, by the way, in the New Testament are called Edomians. And the Herod family of the New Testament are Edomians, or Edomites, if you will. And they built a city called Petra, in which, did you get to visit that one?
The Rock.
The what?
The Rock.
The Rock. And the reason is the Rock is within one of these narrow rocky passes. They went in and carved like this in the faces of the rocks, in the crags of the rocks, what they thought was an impenetrable fortress or city. I'm going to pass this around and let you look at it. Remember, this is carved in the face of a rock. You can't tell the side. If you look at this little guy right down here, that speck is a man. And so you can tell the size of this. And if you had a city like that, made like that, what would you have thought of your security?
Pretty good.
Pretty good, man. Nobody can do... This is Arkansas. Nobody can do nothing to us. All right? And if you were living in a situation anywhere similar to that, and your kinfolks up here in Jerusalem were just getting worn out, and there was a little bit of a grudge or bitterness between you and them, what would you think? Would you get smug?
God, it made me ashamed.
All right. Would you think to yourself, I knew this was going to happen to them sometime? Or would you mutter, I tried to tell them? You know, that's human nature, I think, here. Now, let's think of who the Edomites were then for a second. Who were the Edomites descended from?
Esau.
All right. Now, that means that we need to go all the way back in our minds to Genesis 25 with Jacob and Esau. Tell me a little bit about the relationship between those two old boys. First, which one was the oldest? Esau. What was the relationship between them?
Twins.
Twins. Which one of them, ended up with the birthright? Jacob. But if Esau was older, how did Jacob end up with the birthright?
Sold.
All right, I've heard two versions of this here. Somebody said sold it, somebody said he was tricked out of it.
Yeah.
Are both true?
Yes.
Yes, he was. All right, and remember, one boy was his daddy's favorite. Who was that?
Esau.
Esau was Isaac's favorite. The other boy was his mama's favorite. Who came up with the idea?
Mama
came up with the idea about how it could be done. And Jacob was carried through the process, kicking and screaming and objection, right?
No,
man, he's all for it.
He did what Mama said.
He did what Mama said, but he did it well. How did the two boys end up? I mean, you remember the situation? Esau now showed his character by coming in from the field and knowingly, willingly agreeing to sell his birthright for the high price of what? Pinto beans and cornbread. Not even that good. But a mess of pottage or a bowl of soup or beans. Yeah. And what kind of character did that show on Esau's part? What? How does Hebrews 12 remember Esau? He is the earthly man or the irreligious man who sold his birthright for that bowl of soup. He had his values and his character were such that he did not respect what he could have gotten from his father enough to resist that temptation. Now, as soon as Esau found out what had been done, I mean, Jacob had come in and convinced Isaac that he was Esau, and Isaac had pronounced the blessing over Jacob, and Esau came in. Remember, he had been out in the field hunting, and he came in with the game he had killed and went in to seek his father's blessing and found out it had already been done, had been given to Esau, that Isaac was not going to redo it. What did Esau commit himself to doing?
Chasing and killing
Jacob, which leads to a whole another chapter in the story of the Bible. His mama sends him off to her brother Laban's house, remember? And he's 14 years at least over there before he heads back. You remember the fear with which Jacob, remember when he comes back, he sends his wives and his children and his possessions and all of that for him. And he, to meet Esau, and he brings up the rear, thinking that will soften old Esau's heart. Now, they were reconciled, but a root of bitterness shows up. Now, turn next to Genesis 36. And notice here that when we say the Edomites descended from Esau, we're not just making this up. Look at verse 1. These are the generations of Esau, that is Edom. By the way, what did Esau and also Edom mean? Do I remember? Red. And even though that picture's not in color, can you guess why? I mean, how that fits?
That.
All right, he was a red complexion, but it ends up fitting the rocks there, if you think about it also. Then in verse 8, Esau settled in the hill country of where?
Seir.
Seir, all right, and Esau is Edom, so this is the Mount Seir area that we get here. And then verse 9 also says the same thing. The generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites, and the hill country of Mount Seir. All right, we know about all the relationship that exists now from that. Now, during the... I shouldn't have erased my timeline as easily here, but during the time of the kings of Israel and Judah, whenever the Edomites, this area was conquered by David, I should say that, and then anytime they got the chance, anytime that enemies were pressuring Judah or Israel, the Edomites would revolt during that period of time. And the kings, the succeeding kings of Judah or Israel before that, would have to take time and energy and army and go back down there and calm their kinfolks in Mount Seir and so on. Why were the feelings so bad? You have to look at Numbers chapter 20 to see this. Numbers 20. All right. Israel, the descendants of Jacob, had been in Egypt for over 400 years. God finally remembers, he hadn't forgotten, but he honors his covenant by responding to their cries for deliverance from that harsh slavery. And they start from down here in Egypt up through the land of Sinai, off down up here. And they come in this harsh wilderness, this rugged territory, to the king's highway along the edge of Edom. And it would have been so much easier for them if they could have gone through Edom and up along this valley here and then across into the promised land. So look at Numbers 20, and let's start at verse 2. In order to tell this story, we need to read probably... wait just a second here. Now, we need to start at verse 14 in order to get the point. 14 to 21. Jan, start at 14 for us, please.
From Kadesh, Moses then sent messengers to the king of Edom. Thus your brother Israel has said, you know all of the hardship that has befallen us, that our fathers went down to Egypt. We stayed in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians treated us and our fathers badly. But when we cried out to the Lord, he heard our voice and sent an angel, brought us out of Egypt. Now behold, we are at Kadesh.
All right, and Kadesh is right over in this area, down a little south from this map, okay?
A town on the edge of your territory. Please let us pass through your land. We shall not pass through field, nor through vineyard. We shall not even drink water from a well. We shall go along the king's highway, not turning to the right or left until we pass through your territory.
All right, stop there for a second. Now, describe for me the nature of the request that happens here.
Permit to travel.
All right, all they wanted was permission to travel through the land. Notice that it's prefaced with, you know what all has happened to us. How does Moses identify Israel's relation to Edom? Your brother, you know what all has happened to us and how long we've been in Egypt and what all has happened. We cried to the Lord. He's brought us out. This wilderness is harsh for us to bring our wives and children through. If you'll just let us pass through the territory, we won't bother anything that's yours along the way. Notice how he says there, please let us pass through. We won't get in your fields or your vineyards or drink water from your well. We'll go along the king's highway. We won't turn off to the right or left. And you have to understand, people pass through there all the time. All right, now continue with the story, Jan.
Edom, however, said to him, "You shall not pass through us, lest I come out with sword against you." Again, the sons of Israel came and said to him, "We shall go up by the highway and devour my livestock to drink. Do drink of any of your water, then I will pay its price. Let me only pass through on my feet, nothing else." But he said, "You shall not pass through," and Edom came out against him with heavy force and with a strong hand. Thus Edom refused to allow Israel to pass through his territory, so Israel turned away from him.
All right, now, you notice here that they said, "Please," and he said, "No," and they said again, "Please, plus we're willing to pay," and he said, "No," and brought out his army against them. Now, can you see why you might tend to bristle at that? That might stick in your craw, or it might kind of stay with you. Now, over time, what happens is that Moses, when they've gone all these years now, making this journey, I don't remember the verses in Numbers 2, but it's there, and then in Numbers 25, he tells Israel that he still says to them, "These were our brothers." He's, after it's all done, he looks back on all of it, and he says to his people, Deuteronomy 2, verses 7 and 8, "For the Lord your God has blessed you in all the work of your hands. He knows you're going through this great wilderness. These 40 years the Lord your God has been with you, you have lacked nothing. So we went on away from our brothers, the people of Esau who live in Seir, away from the Arabah road from Eloth to Ezion-Geber, and we turned and went in the direction of the wilderness of Moab." And he says in verse 5, that God had said to him, that this land, is the one who had given this land to Edom. He'd given them Mount Seir for possession, and that they were to purchase the food from them and the money and pay for it with money and so on. So this is why Israel did not fight Edom when they were told no. Deuteronomy 5, 25, I'd like you to notice that Moses tells the people, and more specifically, let me see if I can find it. I read this in my other Bible at home, and maybe I have the wrong chapter. Maybe it's not 25. Maybe it comes later on. There is a statement here which indicates that they were to continue to regard the Edomites as their brothers, and after a certain number of years, I think it's 7 years, then an Edomite was to be regarded as an Israelite. I'm sorry, I didn't write down that passage, and I can't find it, but that's the way that they were regarded that way. Now, years go by. The Edomites rebel against Israel. They're taken by David. They rebel against Israel whenever they can. And then come to Jeremiah 49. And I'd like you to notice that the prophets, as we get closer to this 586 time, Jeremiah does his work before that, the prophets are reminding the Edomites of all the things that Obadiah says. If you notice, Obadiah begins, "Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom, we have heard a report from the Lord, and a messenger has been sent among the nations." And that report could be from Jeremiah 49, verse 7 and following. In other words, I think that Obadiah is a prophet who comes along saying, this is what Jeremiah talked about. Did a bell ring? Both of them, Ron? I should have had a messenger from somebody warning me about that. Please read Jeremiah 49, verse 7, and then also the book of Obadiah next week. And this is one of the ones where I told you it will take us an extra week because the history behind this is so important. So I hope you'll kind of look it over and then plan to be with us next Lord's Day morning. Thank you again for being here. Good to have guests with us. And everybody have a great week and a safe Labor Day.